I'm Jason Lewis.
I'm Flora Gladwin.
And I'm Thomas Mills.
Welcome to Climate Optimists. As a group of concerned citizens, we're on a journey to explore climate solutions and ways that each of us can make a difference.
And as a nonprofit organization, it's donations from listeners that enable us to educate and empower people to become climate advocates. So, whether you're a longtime listener or you've just discovered us and you like what you hear, consider a donation that aligns with that value. Donating is easy. Just head over to our website, climateoptimist.co, and click the donate button. If you're not ready to take the step to becoming a donor but want to help us out, tell all of your friends about us and rate us on your streaming platform.
Yeah, help spread the word. It's how we, you know, expand our reach and ultimately get more folks engaged in climate action.
Mm-hmm.
And in other announcements, as we approach our 100th episode here on Climate Optimists, today is 92. Yeah, I know, hard to believe. We're going to be making a shift to a spring and fall season here on the podcast. While we think that there's a lot of important conversations still to be had on climate solutions, we're looking to invest more of our energy into events, both virtual and local, that help more of our community, you know, get directly involved in climate action. So more to come on that, but we wanted to let folks know we're going to continue on our current schedule through May 7th, and then we'll be off for the summer, starting off again in September.
This week, we're going to be taking a deep dive into a topic that probably isn't top of mind when it comes to climate change, and that's invasive species. All of us have probably heard the term, and most of us will likely have first-hand experience when it comes to invasive plants, insects, or animals. Perhaps not surprisingly, climate change has the potential to increase the spread of certain invasives. Additionally, invasive species can present challenges for implementing natural climate solutions, which are an important tool for reducing carbon emissions and climate impacts. So today, we're going to be talking about invasive species, climate change, and the relationship between the two. But before we jump in, let's talk about this week's reason for hope.
Yeah, and I think we've got a good one this week. Just learned, courtesy of an article from Reuters, that Germany, Europe's biggest economy, is on track to reach their 2030 climate goals, which is definitely worth celebrating. The country's economy shrank by 0.3% last year, which obviously isn't ideal. But the upside of that is their greenhouse gas emissions fell by a whopping 10%.
Wow.
And so, yeah. So with that drop, they're basically on the right trajectory to cut their emissions 65% by 2030, and then to be carbon neutral by 2045. The big drop was in their energy sector emissions, which fell significantly due to rising production from renewables, which covered almost 50% of their electricity consumption last year. So a lot of stats, but yeah, bottom line, Germany is making good progress, and hopefully that, you know, helps incentivize others to deliver on their climate targets too.
And I think it's important to keep in mind that a reduction in the economic output by a country is not necessarily a bad thing, right? If we look at the other indicators in a society, such as happiness indexes or health indexes and things like that, I think that's where we need to be a little more focused on, rather than purely the dollars and cents of it all. Because ultimately, like, a 0.3% reduction in economy size for a 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions is a trade-off in my mind that's well and truly worth paying.
For sure. And I think we're all in agreement here that we need to be looking at other metrics that are probably more important to folks on a daily basis than just the almighty dollar.
Absolutely. And I think that'll be great too, to track them in the future though, expecting good things. All right. So, for our main topic, our guest today is Dow Orion. Dow holds a degree in agroecology and sustainable agriculture from UC Santa Cruz and a Master's of Science degree in climate change, agriculture, and food security from the National University of Ireland, Galway. She is the author of Beyond the War on Invasive Species, a permacultural approach to ecosystem restoration. Dow is an instructor and program administrator in the permaculture program at Oregon State University, and serves on the board of directors of the Center for Rural Livelihoods.
Dow, welcome to Climate Optimists.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
So to kick things off, when it comes to efforts to address climate change, what makes you hopeful?
For me, over the past 20 years or so, being involved in sustainable land management, I feel like right now there's a lot of awareness and momentum that has been built, even though it doesn't seem like it sometimes. I think that there's a lot of willingness to implement new ideas and techniques, strategies at all levels, from like the kind of federal level all the way down to the community level. I think people are really interested in trying out kind of climate friendly solutions, especially in the land management sector. I've really seen that grow over the past several years. So that gives me hope.
Yeah, it seems like there's a ton of promise, you know, when it comes to nature-based solutions and sort of multiple benefits, from a climate benefit to biodiversity benefits, et cetera. Since we're talking invasive species today, I figured we'd start with the obvious question, kind of from your perspective, like, what are invasive species? And then maybe kind of the follow-on to that, why are they a problem?
Invasive species are plants and animals, usually, that are native to somewhere else, and for various reasons tend to thrive in environments, you know, where we live now. So, you know, it's somewhat of a subjective definition, because something that's invasive here where I live in Oregon isn't necessarily going to be invasive in the Southwest. So it really has to do with a lot of environmental factors, land use history factors, things like that. Even the National Invasive Species Council, which is like the federal association that kind of sets invasive species policy in the United States, has a 9-page definition for what an invasive species is. It's not of a concise answer. And I tend to think of it as somewhat subjective based on context and what your kind of goals for land management are. But, you know, there's several in the Pacific Northwest that are notorious, that many people are probably familiar with, like Himalayan blackberry and Scotch broom, reed canary grass, Japanese knotweed. Those are some of the kind of top ones in the area where I live.
And those have come in from around the world, or how they sort of found their way to Oregon in this case?
A lot of them have kind of come in as weeds in like hay that's been imported, or seed that's been imported. Japanese knotweed was first introduced at the Chicago World's Fair in the late 1800s as kind of a novelty plant, back when people were just kind of learning more about the world and what wonders there were. So it really kind of varies, but a lot of them were kind of imported as part of the agricultural trade.
So are there other, you know, our audiences kind of all around the world, are there other examples you can kind of think of that might be familiar to folks, you know, where there was an invasive species that came in and has caused problems for local ecosystems?
Well, a really famous one is kudzu in the southern states of the United States. In Australia, there's cane toads, which are kind of a animal invasive species that has a really interesting story as well. Interestingly, there's not as many in Eurasia. Many of the invasive species that people are concerned about in North America come from that region, but there's not as much going on there, largely because there's kind of more a recent history of glaciation in this area, and so the ecosystems are relatively newer.
So how do they, I mean, you mentioned in the U.S. kind of, you know, things like, you know, imported hay or stuff coming into the World's Fair. I mean, how do invasive species normally spread and take hold?
Well, I mean, I really encourage folks to think about what I call forensic ecology. So look back at kind of the history of a landscape. The techniques and strategies that were practiced by indigenous folks in this area, for example, included prescribed fire. And actually in Oregon, that practice was made illegal in 1859, indigenous burning. And taking that away from the landscape, and at the same time importing a series of European crops, including livestock, into the landscape, completely changed the environment and changed the nature of ecosystem processes, and made especially the kind of hands-off approach that has become the norm in modern kind of conservation, made the ecosystems prone to invasion by species like Himalayan blackberry and Scotch broom and things like that.
Gotcha.
So it's a multi-layered tapestry. And to me, I don't see invasive species as the problem. I see the way that we relate to landscapes as the challenge.
So it sounds like invasive species are a problem, but you're talking about maybe what you view as sort of a bigger problem, which is how we manage our lands. And maybe I'm guessing then that contributes to invasive species being able to take hold.
Yes, definitely. I think that, you know, the idea that's kind of guided modern conservation in the West or in North America has to do with the wilderness ideology that was popularized by John Muir and others that really didn't take into account the role that people, in the case of John Muir, indigenous people, played in creating and maintaining the landscapes that were seen as these pristine environments like Yosemite. You know, John Muir wrote so eloquently about the environment that he encountered when he strolled through Yosemite, you know, but the reality of what happened there is that people were forcibly removed by the U.S. cavalry about 10 years before he showed up. And all of the plants that he mentions in his journals are food and medicine plants and fiber plants, forage plants for deer. And they were cultivated on some level of intensity by the people who lived there for thousands of years. And a lot of that kind of evidence of human stewardship of landscapes is becoming more widely known and understood, you know, from the rainforests of the Amazon all the way up into the, you know, kind of boreal forests of the Yukon Territory. People have had an influence on the characteristics of ecosystems through their active tending practices.
In other words, we've always, or at least in recent history, we've had a role in terms of impacting the ecosystem. And so by removing that, it's actually made it a challenge for, you know, some native species out there to be able to exist in the way that they have.
Definitely. And also, you know, everything that we do now is also, we create ecosystems. Like I like to say, a Walmart parking lot is an ecosystem. Like we design that for a certain outcome. We don't necessarily think about the natural processes that it impinges upon, but
sure.
we're impacting riparian ecosystems because of that parking lot. And so the downstream effects of that also contribute to native species declining and invasive species doing better.
So given that that's a challenge and adds to sort of the uptick of native or invasive species, we put climate change on top of that. How is climate change expected to impact sort of the spread of invasives and maybe how is it already impacting it?
Well, there's been some really interesting studies about that that I looked at pretty in depth when I was writing my book. And, you know, one of them was out of Oregon State University, actually, that looked at the invasive Himalayan blackberry and the native trailing blackberry grown in a laboratory environment where they just kind of started cranking up the CO2 in the lab. And you may be able to guess which one did better for those of you who are familiar with the Himalayan blackberry, because it grew four times as fast as CO2 was elevated. And, you know, the native trailing blackberry just kind of hung out. So it's almost like a selection pressure that we're exerting again through our the increasing levels of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And I think if we studied other invasives, we'd probably find something similar. And then there's also, you know, changes in temperature, precipitation intensity, and amount that we're also contending with that don't necessarily favor the same kind of cohort of native species that may have been present at the end of the last ice age. There was some really interesting research out of the U.S. Forest Service kind of looking at projected changes in ecosystem characteristics west of the Rockies. And, you know, they kind of layered on their best estimates for projected temperature, projected precipitation. That kind of suite of modeling was only able to find compatible niches and places for about half of the existing plant communities, meaning that like for about half of the landscape west of the Rockies, there were no known existing plant community associations that would thrive in the climate projections of 2100. So that was sobering terrain. I mean, hopefully we're not going to get to that point of extreme climate change effects, but we essentially don't know what ecosystems of the future are going to look like.
So, I mean, maybe this is oversimplifying, but it sounds like, you know, based on this modeling, projections aren't good, you know, in terms of it's not going to be helping the existing species that are out there. And but there may be some potential movement that could take place. But then I'm hearing either way, reducing the amount of warming that takes place is going to be important if we want to maintain, you know, existing ecosystems.
Definitely. I mean, already, you know, I'm in the Southern Willamette Valley. We're looking at no Douglas fir survival by 2100 on the valley floor.
Wow.
Like we're, you know, people are anticipating that Douglas fir, you know, the iconic tree of the Oregon license plate, and are essentially not going to survive up until, you know, you get into the Cascade foothills over 2000 feet elevation or so.
Wow. Which obviously has all sorts of cascading impacts. So I guess we're getting into it already, but you know, my next sort of set of questions relate to kind of like, you know, what are the implications of all this? It's obvious to see, it's not a positive thing, but like if we were to sort of look at our food systems, what are kind of the implications for, you know, a changing climate, potential uptick in invasives? And do you have examples that might help us kind of understand that?
Well, one of the things that I think about with invasive species, and I manage them, you know, quite often on my own farm and on other projects that I'm involved in, is, you know, thinking about their characteristics more from a solutions perspective, because, you know, in permaculture, at least, which I'm involved in a lot, we're always saying, or one of the kind of sayings of it is the problem is the solution. Right.
Okay.
So we can, it's a positivist approach to kind of solving some of these seemingly intractable problems. If you're seeing something like Scotch broom or like blackberry that's just growing like really well, you know, that is sequestering carbon. And we can kind of harness that tendency and use it to put it back into the soil. So cut those things down, chip them up, make them into compost, build soil organic matter, which is sequestering atmospheric carbon and putting it in the soil where it's relatively stable. That's the kind of approach that I kind of take, is like thinking about how we can utilize in our quest for more regeneratively managed ecosystems, how are we kind of harnessing some of that amazing energy that we see invasives have and turn it into something that's helping regenerate the system as a whole.
Interesting. So if it grows fast, it can, you know, it's pulling in carbon, and then we can take that to, you know, improve soil health.
Exactly.
What about on the kind of the natural climate solution side of things? I know, you know, we talked about it a little bit in the beginning, and obviously an important part of kind of the suite of solutions that we need to deal with climate change. What risk do kind of invasives pose there?
Well, I mean, I think in some cases it can be trickier to get projects off the ground that might have invasive species to deal with at the beginning. But I do think that, you know, and in my experience managing them and being on other projects where they're being managed in a regenerative way, it's really only like 3 to 5 years until you're past the point where the outcome that you're managing for is happening and the invasives are not an issue anymore. You know, my background is in organic agriculture, so that's kind of how I came at this approach to invasive species, is really, you know, when you're an organic farmer, you really only have a few tools that you can work with.
Sure.
That aren't chemical approaches. And you pretty much just, you know, work through that checklist. You have tillage, you have cover cropping, you have mechanical management with mowing, you have animals, and you have burning. So you kind of try to like match your goal for your ecosystem or kind of where you're working to the tools that are at your disposal. That makes sense. Okay.
So would it be fair to say then that whether we're talking about kind of rangeland for agriculture or, you know, you're growing crops or, you know, out in a forest, you know, ecosystem where you don't have cattle, you're really looking at a suite of tools and the invasive in particular and kind of developing a strategy. It sounds like it's sort of, what do we need to do for this particular condition?
And I really like to say, you know, your goal when you're kind of thinking about, if an invasive species is your concern, the bigger picture goal should be, what are the ecological characteristics that we're wanting to manage for here? So if it's an oak savanna, we're going to have to be managing for the oak savanna, and the scotch broom removal will be a consequence of that. That's the scotch broom removal isn't the goal. It should be, we're thinking about this bigger picture perspective, and we're going to have to take a more active role in maintaining that oak savanna or maintaining, you know, the Douglas fir forest, which, you know, this is kind of another subject, but that type of ecosystem, the old growth forest ecosystem, is less invasive. Like, you don't often see invasive species in old growth type forests because there's not light and there's not nutrients and there's not a lot of, you know, available extras that many of these invasive species like, because they are primary successional species. They like it when it's been disturbed, when there's a lot of light, a lot of nutrients floating around. Those are the conditions that they like.
Interesting. So if you have a really kind of mature ecosystem, you know, it's actually, in a sense, a barrier unto itself of letting invasives in. So versus like sounds like something that's maybe freshly burned or, you know, tilled or what have you, that presents this environment for an invasive to take hold.
Yeah. And in an agricultural context, a lot of people are always like, oh, what do I do about Canada thistle? You know, I till it and then it just comes back. And it's like, well, Canada thistle, if you till it, it has a rhizome. And every time you break up that rhizome into smaller parts, you make a whole new plant. You know, it doesn't want to be tilled.
Right. So, you know, we're talking here, you know, a lot about plants. I'm wondering, are there, you know, when we're talking about insects as invasives, does that same sort of approach make sense where we're saying, you know, let's talk about the ecosystem we want to have and then manage the conditions to create that ecosystem?
Yeah. I mean, I think it definitely does. I think, you know, with things that are ambulatory and eating other things, it becomes more tricky because they can have a more significant impact in a shorter amount of time than a plant that might, you know, it's just easier to approach from a management perspective. But, you know, I think in a lot of the cases, and I really, when I was researching for my book, what I found in looking at, you know, species from the brown tree snake in Guam to zebra mussels in Lake Michigan to the cane toads in Australia, all of these species had a really important story that had to do with massive changes in the landscape predating their explosion in population and contributing to it. So can you
elaborate more on, let's say, one of those species and how, what kind of led to the environment that allowed them to take hold?
Yeah, I mean, the tree snake in Guam is a particularly interesting one, because I was like, okay, this one's hard. You know, the brown tree snake in Guam, it ate a bunch of birds, and it led to their extinction on the island. Most of them still exist on other smaller islands in the area. But when I looked into it further, what I learned was that 95% of the primary forest in Guam had been burned during World War II because it was used as a bombing range. And all of the species of birds that the brown tree snake ate were forest-dwelling birds. And so they were pushed, you know, prior to its, or right around the time that it was also introduced, 95% habitat decline, 5% wow. remaining forest. All the birds are in this one area. The tree snake comes in, eats them, and, you know, in this case, a small island, the birds are not adapted to predation. You know, it's a classic kind of example of what happens in that kind of situation. So it is an interesting example of kind of real-time evolutionary pressure working. But I would argue that, you know, the big selective event was the deforestation and the loss of habitat. And, you know, that to some extent was also the case with the cane toads in Australia. It's definitely the case with zebra mussels of, you know, massively changing aquatic environments and increases in pollution, over-harvesting of native mussels, leading to an available niche for something that does exactly what the zebra mussel does.
In other words, when an invasive is introduced into an environment, what's really allowing it to take hold is that there's something out of balance that created that opportunity. So it isn't just that, you know, you drop an invasive somewhere, it's going to take off. It needs other, you know, things to be in play to allow it to take hold. And so, you know, managing it is looking back at what led to it being able to take hold in the first place.
Yeah, I think in, you know, the majority of cases, it's absolutely true that you have to kind of look at what's going on in the environment that's allowing it to thrive. And your higher leverage point in terms of ecological management is going to come from changing those conditions rather than focusing on eradication.
Well, it's good to hear. I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure I've been guilty too. When you have something you don't want to be there, it's always focusing on eliminating that particular thing rather than maybe stepping back and looking holistically at how it, you know, what was the root cause that allowed it to get in there in the first place.
Yeah.
Well, we've already started to answer, I think, what was kind of my other question, which was solutions, right? If we were to kind of look forward, what do you think needs to be done to, you know, kind of manage invasives in a changing climate?
Well, I mean, I think thinking about ways that they can be managed that provide multiple yields. Like, I really like to think about, you know, the social, economic, and ecological benefits of their management. So, you know, I mentioned kind of managing them in creative ways that creates like compost and mulch that can be used in your garden. But on a larger scale, I think supporting projects that are, you know, and I'm involved in a number of these where, you know, there's goats for hire and or people are kind of incorporating invasive management into their livestock production systems. And, you know, there's several pilot studies going on now that are looking at these techniques so that they can be applied, you know, and have more of a sense of regularity and like,
sure.
So people can just kind of plug and play a little bit with them. All of that kind of research hasn't been done yet because, you know, most of the research on invasive species has come from chemical companies, unfortunately.
So it sounds like there's a lot of research yet to be done, but folks are starting to do that research. I mean, is there funding, you know, available at the levels it should be to facilitate that?
I would say yes. You know, in my consulting business, one of the things I do is I am a technical service provider for the Natural Resource Conservation Service. So I write plans for people who are transitioning to organic. But we also do, in my business, restoration and forestry planning. And the Natural Resource Conservation Service has a lot of money available to folks to do things like timber stand improvement and brush management. And we've been very successful in kind of taking this more organic approach to weed management, invasive species management in these contexts, and getting some of that funding applied to people that are trying to undertake restoration projects on their properties.
Well, now I have a lot of additional questions, ones that I can't necessarily answer within the context of this interview, but super interesting topic. And I guess heartening to hear that while there's a lot of work to do, that there is money flowing, you know, research taking place and an exchange of ideas. Thanks for, you know, coming on the show and educating us a little on invasives and climate change and what we, you know, what we can be doing to restore those ecosystems back into balance.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been great chatting with you.
Flora, Thomas, what did you guys think of the interview with Dow?
Look, I thought it was interesting, but I think we've got to realize that we as humans, probably the preeminent invasive species, have already massively changed the habitat of the world in general. So sometimes we've got to utilize exotic plants or animals to thrive in these highly modified environments that we have created. Because at the end of the day, like, you know, we've got to be sequestering carbon from the atmosphere and we've got to be feeding people. So sometimes that means that we've got to work with what we've got and not keep fighting against a changing system. And an example I take is willow trees. When I was a kid, the government was paying massive amounts of money to farmers and other people to rip willow trees out of river ecosystems. But in doing so, it turns out that, well, one, you often lose the riverbank erosion protection because often it takes a long time to try and get natives reestablished. And the other problem with a lot of the natives is they don't grow over the river. So in our warmer, increasingly warmer summers that we're having through climate change, you're getting more solar radiation into the water. And so the water temperatures are higher, which are affecting the fish populations. And so there's a whole bunch of cascading impacts of trying to remove those invasive species. That said, I do draw the line. I'm very much against any invasive species that either is prickly or poisonous. So those, I have no qualms in removing those from the habitat.
Well, and I don't know if your point, Thomas, is necessarily counter to what Dow was trying to say, which is that we humans are part of the ecosystem, whether we, you know, want to acknowledge it or not. And that when it comes to invasives, you know, you really have to meet a specific definition. And just because, you know, there are a lot of, we'll call them alien species that are spreading to different areas of the world, doesn't always mean they're going to pan out to be negative and turn, you know, categorized as an invasive.
Yeah, that's a great point. I do feel like the ultimate takeaway of this podcast was that if we're going to address invasive species, we have to do it at the local level, listening to Indigenous perspective, really reaching out to the people who have lived realities in places where invasives are impacting the environment. And I'm also going to toss into the mix a little bit of recommended reading. Super short. There's an essay by William Cronin called The Trouble with Wilderness. And it's speaking to that concept that we've talked a lot about, which is the fact that untouched wilderness is kind of a myth. You know, humans have always been involved really heavily in non-human ecosystems, and it's important to consider both those non-human and human interests. So, you know, for me, like Dow spoke to, we do have to find those solutions, which are taking into account cultural circumstances and looking for things that overlap on both beneficial social impacts and ecological impacts. A cool example that I like is jellyfish. They bloom more and more in warmer water. So it's, you know, sea level temperatures are rising, jellyfish populations are exploding. And there's a really good case of this with the Nomura jellyfish, which are big enough that in huge blooms, they can clog power plants. There's a ton of really interesting examples of this in Japan. And, you know, when people were looking for solutions, one of the things that they looked to was local cultural practices, including eating jellyfish. And though Nomura jellyfish, I know, and though those are, you know, bigger, considered less of a delicacy, you know, there was some thought about how could we possibly introduce this as a food source? Are there ways to use invasive species that could be beneficial to the economy, to the people living there, you know, to our taste buds? I think this is something to look into too with insects, but...
Yeah, good point, Flora. I think while I definitely, you know, like the idea of the untouched wilderness and humans not being a part of the ecosystem, I think we have to acknowledge that there are few ecosystems left on Earth that we haven't touched in some way, shape, or form. So being mindful of the impact historically that we've had is important in the context of figuring out what do we do in the future to deal with invasives.
Absolutely.
And so I think as we're talking about all this, I wanted to make sure we give people a sense of how, you know, costly this problem is, because it's not trivial. You know, this report from the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, it's a mouthful, IBES report, about 60% of global plant and animal extinctions can be linked back in some capacity to invasives. You know, we're looking at annual costs to deal with invasives right now, about $420 billion globally each year. And that's been like quadrupling every decade since the 70s. So it is a big deal. And it is a big deal in the context of climate change, because forecasters are saying that we're looking at about a 36% increase in the introduction of what are called alien species by 2050. And so not all of those are obviously going to be invasives, but it just points out to the fact that it's just going to make things, you know, climate change makes things harder for local ecosystems, which makes them more vulnerable to invasives. And then vice versa, once invasives take hold, you know, it can mean that ecosystems are less resilient to climate change.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I was looking at some specific species that I had seen in the Canary Islands, and I came across the Himalayan blackberry, Rubus arminiacus, in the Canary Islands, which are off the coast of Africa. Did a little digging and found out that the plant, which chokes out other species, like you're saying, does really well in climate change, has established a foothold in all continents except for Antarctica, which is wild. I think it originated in East Asia. So that got me thinking a little bit about islands, you know, how these species are getting there and everything. And we've talked a lot in previous episodes about how islands are disproportionately affected by climate change, whether that's, you know, how much they're actually contributing to greenhouse gases versus how they're getting hit with rising temperatures, sea levels, natural disasters. And I looked into it a little bit, and it's a very similar situation where islands lowly contribute to, but are highly impacted by invasive species, which makes sense. You know, islands have a closed loop system, therefore really high endemic biodiversity, which means that colonization and human impact are able to introduce just huge amounts of non-native species that local ecosystems haven't really developed defenses to.
And I think the feral cat has probably got a lot to play in causing those species losses. But there is a good news story in that front, and that is Macquarie Island, which is sort of the last stop between here in Tasmania and Antarctica. That had quite a significant feral cat problem, and there was an eradication program put in place a couple of decades ago, which worked, but there was a downside, and that was that the feral cats there were keeping the local rodent populations in check. And once the feral cats had been removed, the rodent populations got completely out of control. And the rodents started living on, you know, native bird eggs and so forth, and basically destroying the island, tunneling everywhere. So there was a program then launched to eradicate the rodents, rats and mice. And that in turn worked as well. It was a very intensive program. And then more recently, there was a similar program run on a far more tropical island, Lord Howe Island, which is off the coast of New South Wales. And that too, as of, I think, October last year, it was declared rodent free. So that is the beauty of an island. It does give you a sort of more contained location to be able to go and then reverse these, invasive species problems. But when you do that, you've got to look at what those secondary impacts are going to be.
Yeah. Great point.
Yeah. It's not all doom and gloom. I think it is worth pointing out that there are all the solutions we need, you know, out there on the table. This isn't something that we can't address, you know, focusing on the obvious of prevention, you know, responding rapidly, you know, to your point, Thomas, like coordinated efforts to eradicate things. And then, you know, as Dow pointed out, ensuring that local ecosystems are healthy, which makes them, you know, more resilient to invasives taking hold.
So now normally we would be pivoting into what we can do. We always like to end with some good hope for our listeners. But before we get there, we've been talking about, you know, getting listener feedback in our last few episodes. And so now we're introducing a new bit on the podcast to highlight listener feedback, comments, questions, and actions taken for the climate. This week, we want to send out our thanks to Michelle from Bozeman, Montana. Michelle suggested an episode on the climate impacts of AI. So we're currently on the hunt for a guest who can speak to the intersection of AI and climate and hope to produce an episode on the topic soon. Thank you so much for reaching out, Michelle. We absolutely appreciate it. We always love hearing from y'all. If you've recently taken climate action, have a question, or even just a note, please, please, please head to our website and drop us a comment.
Yeah, great point, Flora. I think having a podcast is more interactive, makes it more rewarding. So yeah, we definitely want to hear from you and in helping us, you know, shape what we do here on the podcast and, you know, hopefully answering more questions. So getting to our action opportunities for the week, option number one, we want to encourage folks to get educated on efforts to create healthy ecosystems and, you know, deal with invasives in your area. Do a little research, and you know, there are no doubt organizations around that are helping to work on making those ecosystems more resilient and at the same time addressing invasives. So do your homework and then, you know, sign up to volunteer.
Yeah, absolutely. And for option number two, go check out the National Wildlife Federation page on invasive species. They've got a ton of really awesome initiatives, whether that's signing up for a petition or volunteering or donating. So take a look and find something that you like and want to support.
Nice. I like that. Well, that's a wrap for this week's episode. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. Come back on April 9th when we'll be releasing our next episode. Climate Optimist is made possible by Climate Stewards Collective. You can find us on the web at climateoptimist.co. And don't forget to follow us on social at Climate Optimist Podcast.